From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
Frogfather by Manly Wade Wellman. No, I never liked frog legs very much, not even before what happened, and I wouldn't eat them now if I was starving. This is why. Though I'd known and worked for Ranson Cup for 2 years, all of each day and part of most nights, I remember him clearly only in the dark of that particular night we went frog hunting. Ranson Cup was the sort of man who shoved himself into your mind like a snake crawling into a gopher hole. I defy anyone to find anyone else who liked Ranson Cuff. Maybe his wife liked him, but she didn't live with him for more than 3 weeks. Nobody around the swamps liked him, though he was the best off in money. He ran a string of hunting camps for strangers from up north who came to hunt deer or fish for bass, once in a while to chase bear with dogs. He did his end of that job well, and if he was rude, the strangers figured him for a picturesque character. I've heard them call him that. The swamps people called him other things. To his face, if he didn't have mortgages on their houseboats, cabins, and trapping outfits. This night, we were paddling, he and I, and an old Indian whose name I never knew, in a really beautiful boat he'd taken for a bad debt. Cuff was going to get a mess of frog legs, which he loved, and which he loved three times as much because he'd killed the frogs for them. Cuff would have killed people if he dared, just for fun. I know he would. I'd gone to work for him when I was 15. My old maid aunt, who raised me, owed him money she could never pay. When he told her to, she gave me up to him. And I suppose what I earned went into settling the debt. Slavery. And he was the quickest and oftenest to remind me of it. That night was clear and dark, not a speck of moon in all the stars anyone ever saw at once. They sheened the swamp water up to where the great, fat clumps of trees cuddled it in at the edges. I paddled, the old Indian paddled, and Cuff sat like a fat toad, not a frog, in the bow with his lantern and his gig. The lantern light gave his face the kind of shadows that showed us what he was. His face was as round as a lemon and as yellow and as sour. His mouth was small and his eyes couldn't have been closer together without mixing into each other, and his little nose was the only bony thing about him. "Head for that neck of water northeast," he said. "I haven't ever been in there, but I hear frogs singing. None of them are out along these banks." He cursed the frogs for not being there to kill. I began to scoop my paddle to turn the boat the way he said, but the old Indian pulled his paddle out with little dripping slop. "We don't go there," said the old Indian. He spoke wonderful English, better than Cuff or myself. "Don't go where?" snarled Cuff. He always snarled at people who had to take it. The old Indian had come to work for him, hungry and ragged, and wasn't exactly fat or well-dressed now. "I'm speaking for your good, Mr. Cuff," said the old Indian. "That's no place to stick frogs." "I can hear them singing," Cuff said. "Listen, there must be a whole nation of them."
"They're there because they're safe," said the old Indian.
"Cah!" Cuff spit into the water. "Safe! That's what they think. We're going in there to stick a double mess."
"I'm of the first people here, and I can tell you the truth of it, Mr. Cuff," went on the old Indian with Indian quiet and Indian stubbornness. "I'm surprised you don't know about that neck of water and what's beyond. It's the home of Congabasi."
"Don't know him," growled Cuff.
"Congabasi," repeated the old Indian, "the frog father. He's lived there since the world was made. The oldest one says he's dug the waterways and planted the trees along them, and the frogs are his children."
"Oh, heaven deliver me!" Cuff screwed his fat face into the sourest frown I had ever seen, even on him. "Indian talk I came out to hear. You make me sick. Get going, northwest."
"No," said the old Indian, and laid his paddle inside the boat.
"You're fired, you old—"
And Cuff cursed the Indian every way he knew. He knew a great many ways, including the Indian's ancestry back to Adam and his children, down to the last generation.
"You're fired," he said again. "Get out of this boat."
"Yes, Mr. Cuff," said the old Indian gently. "Put into the shore. Get out. Right here," blustered Cuff. "I'm not taking you to the shore." "Yes," said the old Indian again, and slipped overboard sidewise, like a muskrat. He barely rippled the water as he swam away. Cuff spit after him and cocked his head.
"Hark at those frogs singing," it said.
"Frog father. I'll frog father them. Right in their pappy's dooryard, Johnny," he said to me. "Get us going there." I did all the paddling, and we came to the neck of water. Trees were close on both sides, shutting out the little gleam of starlight, but there seemed to be a sort of green brightness beyond. Cuff swore at me to make me ship my paddle.
"Look at the glow from under the surface," said Cuff. He reached right down into his half-knowledge for a cozy explanation.
"Must be full of those little shiny bugs, like the ones in the sea. Makes it easier for us to find the frogs." I remembered how my grandfather had once said, "You're better off knowing a few things than to know so many things that aren't so." My hunch was that maybe there was rotten wood somewhere around, what old-timers called foxfire. Cuff at the bow knelt with his lantern in one hand and his gig in the other. The gig had a hand-forged fork for its head, 3 sharp barbed spikes. The shaft was a piece of hickory about 4 feet long and as thick as your hand could hold comfortably.
"Snake us along the bank, Johnny," he said. "Now hold her. I see one."
I saw it too. In the light of his lantern, a nice fat green frog on a rock set in some roots. It squatted with its knees high and its hands together in front of it, like a boy waiting his turn at a marble game. Its head was lifted, its eyes fixed by the dazzling glare of the lantern, and those eyes were like precious jewels. Cuff stabbed down and brought it up, squirming and kicking, its mouth gaped open, all those tines of his gig in it. He smacked it on the inside of the boat to quiet it and shoved it off at my feet.
"Got your knife?" he growled.
"And slice off its legs. No snake me along again. I see a bigger one yonder."
"You're tipping me away," he said. "Balance me back, or I'll put a knot in your head with this gig handle."
"It's not me, Mr. Cuff," I argued, but not with my heart in it, because he always frightened me.
"You must be tipping us."
"My weight's here, next the frog, you fool," he said, "and you're tipping us toward the water. You'll have us over in a minute." The boat was tipping, and I shifted to bring her back on the uneven keel, but she tipped more, and I looked around to see what snag might have hooked us. Over the thwart lay something like a long, smooth piece of wood, darkish and dampish in the dim light. Yes, a snag, I thought, but Cuff turned and lifted the lantern, and I saw it was no snag. It was a long green arm. From elbow to fingertip, it was visible above the thwart, wading down that side of the boat and tipping us in the direction of the open water. The ordinary human arm is 18 inches long. I hear the length of the old-fashioned Bible cubit. This was longer than that, 2 feet at least, and probably more. It was muscled smoothly and trimly from the neat point of the elbow to the slender, supple wrist, and beyond the stretched, slim, pointed fingers, but not enough. The hand spread, and it had 3 fingers and a thumb, with no gap where the other finger had been lost. Between them was a shiny, wet web, and it was dead gray, where the arm was covered with sleek green skin blotched twice or three times with brown-black spots as big as saucers. What Cuff said, I wouldn't want written down as my own last words. He said it loudly, and at the noise, another arm came up across the other and hooked there. Then a head came into view and looked at us. The lantern light caught the eyes first. Great, popped-out eyes of every jewel flashing color known to the vainest woman that lives. They looked at Cuff. They were set in a heavy, blunt head the size of a fish basket, and in some ways the head was like Cuff's. But it had no bony nose, no nose at all, and the mouth was a long, curved slit, like a tight, closed Gladstone bag. Under the mouth, where the chin ought to be, the white throat dipped in and out, breathing calmly. The creature lifted a hand, quicker than Cuff could stab. It took hold of the gig just below the head. The hickory was as strong as a hoe handle, but the big green webbed hand snapped off the iron fork just like picking a daisy and tossed it away with a splash. At that splash, every frog stopped singing, and the big elbows heaved a little, shoulders came into view, and I saw what there was to see of the creature, down to where its waist came out of the water. All blotchy green and brown, with a white belly and a wet smoothness, it was a frog. But it was bigger than a man by twice, I suppose. Our boat went over, and I flew through the air and splashed in. That moment in the air was enough to see Cuff caught by neck and shoulder in those 2 green hands, and he went down under water, lantern and all. He hadn't time for another curse. As I sank, I got my arms and legs working. I was more anxious to swim away than swim up. My eyes were open, and I saw under the water by the green light that was there. That part of the swamp must have been the deepest, and many times my length below, I could make out old drowned tree trunks, a lost forest from ancient time of storm and washaway. They were mixed up together as if something had tried to make a hut or nest of them, and I suppose something had. There was a hole among them, like a door, with a green light coming from it, and down toward that hole swam a long green shape, 9 feet at least, from its blunt head to the heels of its flipping webbed feet. Under one arm, it carried Cuff, tucked like a stolen baby, and the other hand helped swim it along. Then I broke surface and churned away, sick and faint and ready to burst with my pounding heart, but making for the little channel by which we had come into the place. I made it, and when I swam out, I heard a long, soft whistle. It made me almost jump out of the water. Another whistle and something dark and swift and silent came toward me. I tried to turn away, but my strength was gone. The dark shape bore close, and it was a canoe. The old Indian put down his hand and helped me get in. Then I lay there and came to life, while he paddled the canoe idly around and around, here and there, on the peaceful starlit water. He did not seem surprised or even curious. He asked me nothing. When I was able, I told him what had happened. It was Kongabasi, he said quietly when I had finished. Kongabasi, the frog father. When a stranger comes to kill children in their very home, will not their father help them? That was something new to think about. I got strength to sit up. We'll have to get help, I said, and go back and...
And challenge Kongabasi? He finished for me. Why? He saved his children.
He took only Mr. Cuff and let you go. Kongabasi never takes any more prey than he needs. But if many men go there with grappling hooks and weapons,
and Kongabasi will have a way to deal with them, and I do not want to see it. I didn't want to see it either. I asked a question. You knew all about Kongabasi, didn't you? You knew what he would do. I saw the old Indian's head nod against the stars. Of course. He has done that to others who came to his home without permission. We first people learned many lives ago to keep to our ways and leave him to his. Kongabasi is not terrible. He is only Kongabasi. You think of him as what we call a Dibar, an evil spirit. We think of him as a part of nature that defends nature's weak things. Men should be a part of nature too, and perhaps they would escape what Mr. Cuff has not escaped. What shall we do, though? I persisted. Oh, said the old Indian, we shall think of a story, you and I, that explains Mr. Cuff's death, a story that white men will believe. Doe. Reuben Pipefeather was an assured young man with a brown, vain face. 80 years earlier, he would have been one of the most accomplished warriors and hunters of his tribe, and one of the most boastful. He wore movie rodeo cowboy clothes. The orange shirt had tan collar, cuffs, and pocket flaps. His dark gray pants hugged his slim saddle-bowed legs and were tucked into high-heeled boots of glove leather. Around his neck was a cherry-red scarf, on his wrist a silver bracelet, on his forefinger a turquoise ring. He carried his white hat in one hand so as to let the hot afternoon sun strike lights from the oiled glory of his long, straight black hair. He had the noble face of a Hiawatha and the manners of a small-time actor. Now we're off the Katanka Reservation, he assured James Randolph, as the white tourist stopped his car where a vile dirt road dwindled to a grass-grown trail. And we're away from those ignorant blanket bucks and squaws that gloom at you and sell you fake jewelry and pottery made in Germantown. You're lucky I was home on vacation from Hollywood. Those old fools wouldn't tell you anything if they knew it, and they don't know it in the first place. The old fools were in reality dignified middle-aged Indians, shabby in blankets and moccasins, but respectable, reserved, and mannerly. Among them were Reuben Pipefeather's own father and grandfather, and these he probably scorned above the rest. Reuben Pipefeather had gone for 2 years to a little Kansas college and thence to the film capital to do extra and bit work in several Western and historical pictures. Now he was back on the Katanka Reservation with the air of a tribal hero looking for recognition and deference. At the trading post, he had really begun chatter with James Randolph, who was interested in Katanka folklore. You said, reminded Randolph, getting out of the car, that here was where the old-timers say that the doe, the bear witch demon, used to be reported. Randolph was plump, 42 mustache and spectacle. He edited a small daily paper in the East, and American myths were his hobby. His 2 weeks holiday among Indian reservations would garner, he hoped, tags of stories for what might someday be a book. Yeah, agreed Reuben Pipefeather, fanning his brown face with a hat. This is free-range government-owned. The folks might graze their ponies here, but they don't. He laughed, teeth white as sugar lumps. They're afraid of old Doe. He might eat the ponies, they think. And them. The country might be haunted, Randolph reflected as he gazed. The reservation land was mostly gently rolling prairie with tufts of willow or cottonwood scrub. But here the rolls became hills. From lesser rises near at hand lifted more distant heights crowned with brush and trees and cobbled with boulders. Wild-looking, yes, and to a superstitious imagination, baleful. Doe lives here, said Randolph. This bear witch? What's he supposed to be? He'd scare even American kids, said Reuben Pipefeather, grinning more widely. They say he's part man and part bear. One side like each, I guess. A couple of old granddads say they saw old Doe's tracks. 1 foot like a man, one like a bear. You know. Fluidly, Reuben Pipefeather's free hand stretched in the air. What do you reckon? Too much fire water or a trick shoe to make scary marks? Randolph had a camera slung on a strap over his tweed-clad shoulder. He focused and snapped a shutter at the hills. "Nice bit of landscape," he said. "What's that sparkle in front of us? Beyond the high grass, next to the cottonwoods." "That's one of the things I mean," Reuben Pipefeather shaded his eyes to peer. "Doe's bathtub. When I was a kid, one of the squaws showed me a couple of others. Doe's supposed to wash himself there now and then. I was scared, but plenty." They walked towards the brown sparkle. It was a sort of muddy tank-like pool, like a big bathtub, at that in size and shape. Nestling among grass-grown rocks, its brown surface stirred, as though with a gentle simmer of heat. "There's a spring in there," said Randolph. "Sure, sure. The old folks say the spring oils up your joints or cures your bellyache, but nobody uses it, not if those reported around." Reuben Pipefeather laughed again. "I wonder how that yarn started and how fast and far it's grown." Producing tobacco sack and papers, he vindicated his Hollywood cowboy training by rolling a cigarette with one hand. Randolph squatted and dipped fingers in the pool. It felt faintly warm, perhaps from the sun. Then he studied the scum on his fingers. It was oily, sticky. Still squatting, he peered at the overflow in the waterside grass, then rose and studied a stretch of earth beyond, damp and bare. "You say nobody comes here?"
"Nobody."
Reuben Pipefeather's brown lips pursed and blew a smoke ring in the still bright air. "But I see tracks." Randolph pointed. "Fresh, they look to be." He walked around the edge of the pool. The damp earth held two tracks at the very brink and two more beyond, pointing away. Behind him, Randolph heard the sudden, sharp intake of his companion's breath. He glanced back. Reuben Pipefeather's face was brown and jaunty no longer, but gray and sick. Reuben Pipefeather's lips sagged. The cigarette fell from him. His eyes were wide. "Will you look at that?" he whispered hoarsely, and Randolph looked. A moccasin track. "But the other?" Broad, strong, flat, it looked like the impress of a great, long axe head. The toes, yes, the toes had, each at its end, a slash-lean mark. Even James Randolph, who was no woodsman, knew what a bear track must look like. "Mr. Randolph," Reuben Pipefeather was badly frightened, "let's get out of here."
"Why?"
"You know what those tracks are, Mr. Randolph." The young Indian was walking away.
"You said you didn't believe."
"I do now, and I am not going to stay. Come on."
Randolph did not move, and Reuben Pipefeather was heading for the trail.
"Then I'll foot it back to this post." And he moved faster than one would think possible in those cowboy boots.
Randolph smiled under his mustache. Undoubtedly, the youngster had brought him out here to play a joke. Must have made the tracks himself and pretended. But nobody, Indian or white, could have made his face grow gray like that. Another study of the tracks, Randolph wished he knew more about animals and their feet. This might be a mockery of a bear track, achieved by a distorted claw-fringed moccasin. Again, it might not. He focused his camera again and snapped it. The metallic click was answered by a deep grunt from one side, and Randolph fairly whipped up his head and stared. No wonder, he thought, he had been left alone at the pool. Even with a grunt to give him direction, he looked twice before he saw the grunt maker, squatting crumpled beside and half behind a clump of big dried weeds. It was a lean figure, swathed in an ancient blanket of a brown that was bleached and weathered by a dead leaf paleness. Abundant and untidy gray hair bushed over a swarthy face from which bright eyes watched Randolph. A second grunt acknowledged Randolph's gaze.
"Ahi," Randolph managed an Indian greeting.
"Good afternoon," replied a deep, gentle voice. "It is hot."
"You speak American," said Randolph gratefully.
"I have learned many tongues," was the rejoinder, "among them the American." The crumpled figure stirred and rose. The blanket fell from his chin to earth, covering an ancient leanness like a toga.
"Is that what they call a camera?"
"Yes," said Randolph.
I took a picture of these tracks.
The old man came forward slowly, stiffly, but not shakily. Randolph saw beneath the abundant gray hair a face that matched the toga blanket. A face dark and Roman, with a firm mouth, great hooked nose, deep steady black eyes, a criss-cross and labyrinth of aged lines and wrinkles.
Yeah, said the gentle voice deeper still. Those tracks, what will you do with the picture?
Publish it. Show it to other people. Find out what it is.
Those tracks, repeated the ancient.
Prepped a left hand to gesture. It was a lean and withered hand, brown and dry-seeming as a sheaf of twigs, but it had flexibility, even grace. I heard the young fool talking.
He lost his doubts in the time it takes to draw one quick breath.
You believe in Do? Prompted Randolph, hopefully. A brief nod of affirmation.
Yeah,
because I know I am older than any, perhaps, of those others. The thin hand wafted a little gesture towards the reservation. Glancing that way, Randolph saw that Reuben Pipefeather had gone out of sight around the bend of the road. They have funny beliefs. Most of them they made up. But I know about Do. American, where are you going?
Back to my car, Randolph pointed with his thumb. Will you ride with me?
You do not want to trail Do by his tracks?
Randolph shook his head.
The damp earth ends here in the coarse grass. I'm no trailer.
Not you, but I'm a good trailer. The draped old leanness moved away through the rustling grass and stooped.
Another grunt.
Here are more marks. Will you come?
Randolph felt excited, mystified.
Wait, isn't that a name of an evil spirit?
Something half man and half bear?
So it has been believed, the brown face peered back. But I am not afraid, American. Are you?
Randolph scoffed away the notion.
Of course not, old man.
Then come on. We will follow Do's trail. Side by side they did so. At least Randolph kept pace and tried, without success, to see what the bright old eyes kept finding among the grass. Once or twice Randolph spied a broken stem, a crushed leaf. That was all. He remembered that the old wild Indians could follow a trail across a naked rock. But maybe this old chap was joking, pretending, like Reuben Pipefeather.
See, said the ancient, and again his left hand moved free of the blanket folds.
Do was here. A bald splotch of ground among the graft tufts, full of fine dust, and in it a single track, broad and flat and fringed with claw slashes. Randolph paused, scolding himself for feeling cold.
How did he make that mark?
With his naked foot.
He doesn't wear a trick shoe?
American, said the old man in dignified protest. Even that young idiot tells a true track from a false one.
Maybe it's a real bear track, offered Randolph, not a witch's track.
There have been no real bears here since the American took the country from the Indians. I would be more surprised to see signs of a real bear than to see signs of Do.
He moved ahead with a stiff but nimble gait.
He said, another mark. See, the claw touch on those broad leaves. Da headed into this little ravine. It will lead to where he lives, among the hills. So confidently and promptly did the old Indian take his way in the direction of the ravine that Randolph was ashamed to linger. One backward glance showed his car parked on reservation ground, far away and alone.
Come, his companion urged him.
Randolph decided to come.
Tell me about Da, he asked.
Da is Da. There is nothing like him.
Apparently not, agreed Randolph, but his mind was on other bear demons and tales he had heard. The Lapps had a bear spirit alternately to be feared and prayed to.
The Ainus, those inexplicable white savages with beards on Japan's northernmost islands, believed that they descended from a bear hero. And only Majikiwis, the Chippewa wind god, dared challenge Mishimakwa, a monster bear that was in Hiawatha.
What did the Piegan say? The tribe called Blackfeet?
Bear is near kin to man. Do not eat it,
or kill it without a muttered apology for killing a brother.
But you said you knew about the, persisted Randolph.
He hoped that the old Indian would not fall silent. If they did that, there was no talking with him. The firm mouth was touched with a close smile like the smile of a patient grandfather.
I will tell you, American, it all happened in an old man's lifetime ago. In those days, the Indians worshipped their own way, before the Americans forbade them.
The Americans don't forbid now, Randolph made haste to remind. They had entered the gully between two bluffs, and he had a little difficulty with his footing, for the low point had been washed by recent flows of rainwater until the stones were loose underfoot. He slipped and stumbled, but the old Indian stalked surely along. On either side of them rose boulders and thickets of brush above, shading away the sky and the sunlight. It reminded Randolph of the strange rough country into which Rip Van Winkle strolled to meet the dwarfs with their cask of enchanted liquor.
The Indians are allowed their old beliefs, elaborated Randolph. The Indian Bureau has seen to that for more than a dozen years, ever since Secretary Ikes and Collier.
Ah, that is true now, but in the meantime, said the old man, and he spat. The tribes have forgotten most of their old worship ways. They forgot the fasting that young men must undergo to find their friends among the animal spirits. I want to tell you about a young man, a boy whose fast was one of the last held by his tribe.
Do tell me, begged Randolph.
The boy was growing into a man. His uncles and grandfathers prepared him by singing and telling him things at night. On the chosen morning, he left his father's lodge and came somewhere out here. Once again, the thin old hand made a flourish of indication. He made a shelter of brush and spread his blanket and lay there. He had water in a clay pot, but no food. He must not eat or sleep or move until he heard the voice he had come to hear. Randolph remembered hearing or reading something of that old custom. A youngster waited until hunger and lonely quiet half hypnotized him into what he fancied as a vision, generally of some animal spirit. That became his secret medicine, his focus of personal worship.
The boy stayed a long time, the quiet voice continued. Most fasts in those old years lasted 3 days, or four at most. But the boy watched the sun rise and set 6 times, 7 times, 8. He was afraid that he was not wanted by any spirit. But then he remembered that if such a wait happened, the waiter was destined for something big in medicine. At the 9th rise of the sun, it was that the spirit of the bear, Nakuma, came and spoke to him. The bear stood thus. The old man stopped and drew himself up, straight and dignified. For all his leanness, he suddenly put on an aspect that was ursine. He gazed solemnly at Randolph.
The bear, continued the old Indian, spoke to the boy. It called him brother and son.
Nakuma, the spirit of the bear, saw that Do was weak and faint and brought him food for them to eat together. Nakuma said that he had waited long to try Do, to find him worthy of receiving the power of the spirits that could do almost anything and everything. Nakuma gave the powers to the boy.
What powers? Randolph was a little tired. He sat down on a projecting gnarled root against one bluff that hemmed in the gully. The car, the trail, the muddy pool were out of sight and worlds away.
Nakuma showed him how to cure a wound by breathing on it, said the old man, standing straight and motionless.
Nakuma showed him how to heal the sick by chewing medicine plants and breathing on the sick ones.
Nakuma showed him how to mix war paint that would turn the blows of an enemy and give him a power in his right hand that would strike a blow of death every time.
Nakuma whispered in his ear, and Do could understand all languages.
Nakuma hugged him in his arms, and Do had strength greater than the strongest warrior.
Again the firm mouth smiled, close-lipped.
Why do you ask me to tell you these old things? You are an American. You laugh at me inside yourself.
You do not believe.
Randolph remembered his high school reading, the essays of Benjamin Franklin, Franklin's remarks concerning the savages of North America, teeming full of wisdom and understanding. Savages we call them because their manners differ from ours, which we think the perfection of civility. We think the same of theirs. And that anecdote about the colonial missionary who called the beliefs of an Indian host fable, fiction, and falsehood, to that accusation that dignified savage had returned. My brother, it seems that your friends have not done you justice in your education. They have not well instructed you in the rules of common civility. You say that we, who understand and practice those rules, believed all your stories? Why do you refuse to believe ours? Wonderful poor Richard. Well, might Hume call him the first philosopher of the New World. He, Randolph, would profit by this very lesson. But I do believe, old man, he protested, and as he spoke, he almost felt that he did believe. Maybe you say that because you think you must, demurred the Indian, still straight, dignified, and motionless in his close-drawn blanket. Why must I believe if I do not want to? Demanded Randolph plausibly. I believe, I tell you, your words are honest. Do me the favor to think that my words are honest, too. Then, and a courteous duck of the head, I can tell the rest. It is not much. Doe came home with those powers of which I speak and used them to help his friends. But he had changed in some ways that frightened the Indians. He seemed to have a bear's weight and strength sometimes. When angry, he would growl as a bear growls, and his teeth grew big and sharp, something like a bear's teeth. Because his people were afraid of these things, they avoided him. The gentle old voice sounded sad. They did not trust him, even when he showed himself a great healer and a great chief in war. When the Americans came in, he called on them to fight for their lands and freedom and children. They turned from him. The Americans, they said, were men, and he, Doe, was not a man. Silence. And then Randolph made bold to prompt him. Doe was angry. He growled and roared like a bear. He cursed them in the name of Nakuma. He spit on the ground and went away from them. It was then that he changed even more than at first. One of his feet became a bear's hind paw. One of his hands became a bear's front paw. No more did he ever help men. All his powers he turned against them. It was bad to live alone and hate his kind, but his kind had turned against him. Yes, that was bad, agreed Randolph diplomatically. The other Indians called him dangerous. Once or twice they tried to kill him, but he killed them. Killed them like beetles. Aye. The smile faded, then came back. Well, that is all the story of Da. The thin old hand made a motion as if casting away a pinch of sand. I have finished. But after that? After that, Da has kept his own place and men have learned to leave him alone. You are sure you believe all this? I believe it, Randolph told them dutifully. The gray thatched head turned, peering. I see more tracks, fresh tracks. And beyond, look! He led Randolph to a great dead stub of a tree, a dozen feet high that was still rooted strongly to the rocky floor of the gully. Dog's marks! The rough bark was rent and torn by great talons high and low. Randolph remembered his Ernest Thompson Seton. Bears mark threes like that. See, said the old man. He rubbed himself here. There are hairs. Let me take a picture of it, said Randolph, and did so. Take a picture of that, too. The skinny hand pointed, and Randolph saw, under a rocky projection a dozen yards ahead, the black mouth of a cave or a hole. From that manifest den of something large and wild, Randolph involuntarily started back, but his companion stumped toward it. Randolph made himself approach. What is inside? He whispered. The gray head shook. Nothing. Doe is not inside. Be careful, warned Randolph. You can't be sure. But I know, the gentle voice told him. Wait, stay. Stay back. Look at the tracks. Randolph pointed to a string of them, here plainly visible in earth dampened by recent showers. Alternately, the moccasin tracks and the taloned breath of the bear mark led straight to the cave and in. "Let's go back," said Randolph, his voice a shaky hoarseness.
"Did you forget my story, American?"
"No, I left something out. When Dole left his people, the spirit of Nakuma changed them more. It turned his feet so that they were pointed backward on his ankles. Those tracks," the old man pointed, "lead out, not in the cave."
"Now wait," protested Randolph. "I've heard that story in other places too, about a demon monster's feet being turned around. But it's a stupid impossibility. How could they be turned backward?"
"Like this." The brown hand took hold of the blanket and lifted it a few inches, and Randolph could see the old Indian's feet. Lean, pole-like shins came straight down to the ground as if driving into it. Two flat projections extended backward. The blanket hiked higher. Randolph saw a moccasin and something else. Broad, heavy, shaggy, with grizzled hair, a foot like a bear's, but pointing backward.
"I am truly sorry," said a gentle voice. "But back there near the reservation line, you used that camera. You took pictures of the tracks. You would have talked about it in other places. More Americans might come, many more. And the Americans have powers of their own that might even defeat and destroy the powers given by the spirit bear Nakuma." Randolph tried to back away, but he felt his knees quivering, and he feared that he would stumble and fall.
"And you," he stammered, "you are..."
"Yes, that is right."
The old man dropped the blanket. He was naked, lean, brown. Up one flank, over his shoulder and arm and taloned arm paw, ran a thick tangle of coarse fur. He opened his mouth, and Randolph saw the light gleam on great pointed fangs.
"I am Do," said Do, and leaped upon him.